Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, factoids, and health information, science information in the news, and answers to your questions and emails. I thought we'd start out with a couple of emails. This one from Janet in Seaside. My 92-year-old father fell last Friday. His hip was broken, and he had surgery on Saturday. All my knowledge is second and third hand from family members. Mom's 80 and updates as best she can. She tells me today that he's very disoriented, confused, and scared. She put him on the phone just now, and he couldn't even put together how to say hello. Until the surgery, he was doing very well in this department, and he reads 3 papers a day and always up on current events. There's also some question that he may have had a heart attack during the event where he fell, and of course it could be also during the surgery, because that puts a great strain on the heart. So what Janet wants to know is, what's up with my dad's brain, really? Can this be caused by drugs, and is it reversible? Well, yes, Janet, it absolutely is high probability that a combination of the side effects of the anesthetics, the pain pills, these are things that have central nervous system activity, and it's probably really affecting him because he's having to process and eliminate these drugs. So that plus the pain, very disorienting. And you shouldn't necessarily worry that he's going to, you know, leap into an Alzheimer's state. I think that's really unlikely. It will take time for him to metabolize the drugs. And you said in your letter that you're going out there for Christmas and we're wondering, you know, what questions to ask. Realistically, I think that the most important thing that you could do usefully would be to find out, you know, how severe a heart attack he's had, whether they've done an echocardiogram and looked at an ejection fraction to see how much function he may have lost. And in terms of something practical that you can do that might help reorient your dad, bringing family photos, if there's music that your father really likes and used to play for himself a lot when you were growing up or when he was younger, that would be great. If he's a sports guy, then, you know, games that he liked. But essentially, things that are going to go back a couple of years or longer. But you can go back 20 or 30 years and bring photos from childhood or from earlier Christmases. That's the best memories for someone who's in this situation in terms of helping them reorient. Those deep memories tend to be the most accessible. What happened last week is like gone, but what happened in 1963 is probably still there. So just as a present to your dad and doing one of the things that you can do this year now, because I know you want to do something for him, is go through the family photos, maybe put together a little album and sit there and play Remember When with your dad. And just for everyone who has an older relative, sitting down and asking them about their life when they were young. You know, what I recently was gifted with a book that is sort of a guided interview through a person's life. And it asks questions like, what were Saturdays like? What did your family do on the weekends? What were your favorite things when you were growing up? And these are questions that maybe we've never really talked about to our parents. And there's those 2 or 3 tired stories that we've heard 1,000 times, but there's a lot more there. And we just need to ask. And we have Bill on line 5. Hello, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. I got a compliment. You're so articulate and patient. I really appreciate the show. But I just had a thought and a comment on the octogenarian man who broke his hip.
Yes.
We're assuming that the fall in the first place wasn't caused from a stroke that's left him with aphasia. So if, you know, the mental status doesn't clear up in the next few days, certainly imaging, if it hasn't been done, would have to be a consideration, I would imagine, that he might just have an expressive aphasia because he had a stroke and that's why he fell down and broke his hip.
You know, that's an excellent idea, and it did not cross my mind. But yes, you're absolutely right. The stroke may have been the precipitating event for the hip fracture.
Sure. But it's probably been discerned already that that's been ruled out. But, you know, and then he's weak. He can't move that leg. It could be on the other side of a CVA on the right side. And he can't move his left hip because he had surgery on it, right? Anyway, I love your show.
Well, thank you for the comment. That was really an excellent thought. I hope that Janet's listening, yes. Or at least Janet's doctor.
Okay.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Bulla in Carmel.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Is it Bulla?
I wanted to ask you, for someone that I know, about hair loss because of stress.
Yes.
I've been on the web and found something called Hair Essentials, and it's herbal things. And I wondered if you had any recommendations.
Well, let me just start with saying that hair loss from stress is a definite phenomenon. It does exist.
Yes, it has a long name. I found I can't pronounce it.
Yeah, telogen effluvium.
Right.
It sounds so educated, though. Telogen effluvium. Yes, ma'am, you have telogen effluvium. Take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. As far as the herbal shampoos and herbal products are concerned, there's not really a lot of supporting data to back these up. You can make thin hair or thinning hair look better by thickening it, by adding something that will stick to the cuticle and thicken the hair. You can do things that will improve the texture or change the electrostatic properties and give the illusion of greater hair. But the only thing that's ever been shown in any kind of controlled situation to grow hair is really the drugs minoxidil, which is topically...
Could you spell that?
Yeah, M-I-N-O-X. It's called Rogaine is the trade
Rogaine,
name.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Rogaine does actually work, and it will stimulate the hair follicles.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of studies showing, we figured this out because it was a side effect of Rogaine, which is minoxidil, which is an antihypertensive drug. But the side effect was it made you grow hair. And some enterprising person said, well, maybe if we used it topically, it might just grow hair where we want it. And lo and behold, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are a couple of drugs that prevent hair loss in men, related to testosterone.
This is a woman. Hmm.
Yes, but this happens because hair is very physiologically active. So you spend a lot of calories, a lot of energy, and a lot of protein growing hair. You probably didn't know this, but the average person puts on 12 feet of hair a day. If you took all of the hair and added up that tiny little incremental growth on your scalp, it would stretch out to 12 feet. Now, that's a lot of protein.
Goodness, yes.
And when the person is challenged physiologically, either by an illness or by psychological stressors, the body says, wait a minute, I don't really need to be growing all this hair right now. I need these calories for something else. And so it will shunt the growing hair follicles, which are maybe 20 to 30% of the follicles at any time are growing. It'll shunt them into the resting phase. And the resting phase lasts about 3 months, and then that hair falls out. So a whole bunch of hair kind of gets jumped into the next phase, which in 3 months will result in it falling out. And when that 3 months comes along, then suddenly the person's having mountains of hair, what seems, you know, double the normal amount. And in fact, it is double. And they worry it's going to progress and they're going to end up losing all their hair. There's also something called alopecia areata, which is a hair loss that's generally localized. And in that case, it's a complete loss of function of the follicles.
Now, this is definitely all over and stress-related.
But is the hair loss complete? Is the scalp...
It's all over, yes. It's general.
So,
all
of the hair has fallen out, absolutely all of it?
Yeah.
If you looked with a magnifying glass on the person's scalp, there's not a single little bud of hair coming up anywhere.
I don't know.
All right. This is an important distinction, however. Because if they really have no hair at all, nothing trying to grow, then that would fall into the category of an autoimmune disorder called alopecia areata.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, yes, it's also stress-related, as are many autoimmune diseases. That one actually has a treatment, and it's a bizarre concept, but you actually irritate the scalp. One bizarre treatment I heard, it was a scientific study, and it actually showed results, was they used roost toxin. So they used the toxin in poison oak.
Oh.
So they gave the person basically a massive case of poison oak of the scalp, and it jump-started the hair growth. I think by overactivating the immune system with the toxin, they turned on the brake, basically. The immune system was sort of active against itself. They made it more active, and that resulted in the whole thing shutting down. In other words, it set up the counter-regulatory functioning, which hadn't been firing off for the autoimmune disease. Anyway, in terms of the herbal products, I'm not enthusiastic about most of the things that are sold as having much validity.
All right. It sounds like, you know, so many people writing in and saying how much it's helped. You never know. There are scams and scams, I know.
Well, there's that, and there's also the fact. So 10,000 people buy it. It works for 100. They write in glowing reports.
Right.
The other 9,000 write in and say, give me back my money, those letters don't end up on the website.
No, it's not. So, it's really
how expensive is it? I mean, is it something?
Oh, it's only $39. It's not an expensive thing.
So you could just kind of do it and see.
Well,
makes
trying,
a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like sometimes just making an action.
Yes.
Will have an effect. I don't know if you've raised children, but there's this odd phenomenon where the kid looks really sick and then you take them to the doctor's office and they perk right up in the waiting room. So
I had a dental toothache.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's as if the act of deciding to go to the doctor is somehow therapeutic. And I see this all the time. People are sort of vaguely disappointed because they wanted me to see how sick the baby was, and now the baby is like cooing and playing with me, and it's like, oh, okay, I believe you that she was really sick an hour ago. The thing is, so, you know, making a sort of request to the universe to heal you is not such a bad idea. Seems to work a lot of the time.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, you're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I'm calling for a friend, and this friend takes 80 milligrams of Lipitor, and he also takes, I think it's 10 milligrams of Zetia. He hasn't met anyone who has taken 80 milligrams of Lipitor. Almost everyone has taken like 40 or 60 mm-hmm. at the worst. And so he's kind of wondering if this is kind of too much. About 15 years ago, he started getting cholesterol problem. And then they start with 20 milligrams, and then 40, and then 60. And he had tried high triglycerides, so they put him on Zetia. And he's wondering if this is good for the body to be taking so much of these medicines.
It's kind of a rock and a hard place situation because he probably has risk from the neutral state of taking nothing because of his high cholesterol. Maybe he has some inflammation. There's a marker for inflammation that they should be looking at called an hsCRP in your friend. And he should be looking very carefully at his diet as well. If he smokes, he has to quit. But because what you eat does influence what your cholesterol levels will be. And so increasing the amount of fiber, for example, and eating soy protein and certain vegetables, actually eggplant and okra, among them oat bran. These are all things that he can be doing that may allow him to use a lower dose of the statin, because Lipitor is a statin, and as a class, the higher you go on the dose, the more likely you are to have the bad side effects. One of the bad side effects is inflammation of the liver, and the other bad side effect, which is quite rare, is damage to the muscles or myopathy. And that comes in a low-level damage to the muscles, which doesn't show up on blood tests, but shows up as aches and pains. And a high level, which is, again, quite rare, which can actually damage the kidneys and lead to kidney failure because you lose so much muscle tissue all at once. That muscle tissue breaks down into something called myoglobin and blocks up your kidneys, like sludge in the fuel filter of your car. So you absolutely want to use the lowest statin dose required to normalize a person's cholesterol. And what normal means depends upon whether he's had a heart attack or a stroke or whether he's diabetic or hypertensive. What you ask is a complicated question because you have to look at the risk of doing nothing, which may be considerable in the case of your friend, versus the risk of doing something, which is what your question is really about.
He had a stint about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they put him on Zetia, and raised it to, about 2 years before that, they put him on a higher dose of Lipitor.
Mm-hmm.
He said he doesn't have these muscle aches. Could you have damage to your muscles without having the aches?
Yes, but you probably wouldn't. Is he taking CoQ10? That would be another thing that he could do that would, I think, lower his risk.
Okay, I'll suggest that to him.
Yeah, maybe 150 milligrams, and that's to just kind of put back what you've messed with, because when you take a statin, you interfere with the body's ability to make this very important antioxidant. Well, I think if your friend had a stent, that means that he has disease, that he has the disease. So it's not a risk factor anymore. It's an actual ongoing disease. And we know that inflammation is really key to block the ongoing disease. So actually, the effect of the Lipitor may have less to do with the absolute cholesterol numbers than with the anti-inflammatory effect. You said, mentioned he had high triglycerides. Is he diabetic?
No.
Does he eat a low-starch diet? He should.
Yes, he does, and he does eat a lot of fiber one.
All right. Another thing to think about would be oat bran.
Okay.
And oat bran has a different characteristic than the fiber that's in fiber one, but that's a good fiber source for colon health, but it doesn't actually have the cardiovascular benefit that the oat bran would.
Is the liver function test once a year adequate?
Very good question. I have no idea. Nobody really knows what we should be doing as far as the liver test is concerned. In general, if the liver enzymes are in the normal range while he's on 80 milligrams, then I would recheck them when I added another drug that might interact with the same cytochromes as the Lipitor. So,
could you name a couple?
No, I can't. I would have to look it up. It's just nothing I can keep in my brain.
There are some other drugs that would be contraindicated.
What you do, it's really simple. You look in the PDR and you see what enzyme breaks down Lipitor.
Okay.
And I, off the top of my head, I'm not sure which one it is.
Okay.
Before you add another drug, as a clinician, what I do is I say, okay, I want to give this person an antidepressant. So I want to give them an antidepressant that's metabolized in most people in a different pathway. I don't want to give a drug that's going to suppress the breakdown of the Lipitor, for example. So I want to give something that doesn't crowd out the breakdown of the Lipitor because I'm giving a big dose of Lipitor.
Uh-huh.
That's a rational way of approaching polydrug therapy. I have to say we are not quite ready for prime time as physicians. Most of us don't do this. But when you're getting to high doses of drugs that are potentially hepatotoxic, we should be doing it.
Okay.
Okay.
I just want to say that the people that listen in, my friends are most appreciative. They listen to you. I've got a whole lot of new people listening to your program because you give such a great advice to people.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you so much.
Have a wonderful holiday season.
You too.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Gene in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gene. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Let me ask a quick question to follow up on the woman who was talking about the hair loss. I came in late on that one.
Yeah, sure.
You asked her, did the person have no hair at all?
Yeah.
That was the autoimmune part. What if they had some hair?
Well, it depends on where they've got it. The autoimmune thing starts as little round holes. It sort of looks like bacteria or fungus growing in a petri dish. So you'll have this totally round, hairless area, and eventually it can expand to cover the entire scalp.
Uh-huh.
That may never grow back. That's the sad thing about that one. That can be a permanent loss. The place where you wear a yarmulke?
Yeah.
If you're Jewish?
Well, that's pretty normal for guys like me.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other classic form of hair loss is from the temples going back. So you kind of get a very exaggerated widow's peak. And hair loss in those two areas is related to testosterone.
Huh.
And it turns out that there's an enzyme that puts a hydrogen group on the testosterone, and that enzyme is present in the hair follicles. If you block that enzyme, which is what Propecia does, you increase the amount of hair growth and stop the breakdown and the loss of hair that's part of a testosterone-related midlife change.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's bizarre.
My question is, I'm getting a shot. I have trigger finger.
Uh-huh.
And I'm using the corticoid.
Cortisone.
Cortisone. I think this would be the third one. I get it, you know, about every 6 months the finger starts deciding not to be happy. And it goes right in the joint near the palm there of my middle finger. And the question is, should the shot be so painful? First time I got the shot, it didn't hurt at all. And I know he's using a deadening thing, too, called Marcaine, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all in one in the needle? Or would I get... It's all in the needle, period, then?
Yeah, most people, when they do an injection, will mix the local anesthetic with the cortisone.
Okay.
And the injection of trigger fingers, in general, is painful.
Yeah, because is he trying to squeeze it between those little things that are tendons that are shutting off or something?
Let's talk about trigger finger for a moment. You want to imagine this hand as a skeleton. Just visualize those bones and understand that they're hinged. And then you want to think about, well, I've got ropes that I'm attaching to the tips of the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pull on those ropes with muscles in my forearm. And, you know, think about it. If you put a rope on the tips of the fingers and then you pulled on it with the muscles of the forearms, the rope would shorten and the whole palm of your hand should just bow out and it's called bowstringing. I mean, everything should just kind of stretch out because the skin would be stretched by the rope as it shortened. But that doesn't happen because the rope is actually pinned at intervals to the bones. So instead, the fingers bend rather than the skin of the palm stretching out. You with me?
Yep.
Okay. Well, those places where the tendon is pinned are actually tubes, like soda straws. And the tendon moves inside the tube.
Oh.
Now, over time, you know, the tendons aren't completely contained in the tubes. There's places where they're out. And at those places, they're subject to trauma. They can be injured by gripping, let's say, an axe chopping wood or the handles of a mountain bike or a tennis racket, any kind of tubular structure that you might hold in your hand. You can kind of rub and injure the tendons, and they'll develop a little scar tissue, and the scar tissue might get a little calcium in it, and you get a bump on your rope. So as it tries to slide through the guide tube, as it tries to slide through that soda straw, it'll catch.
It'll catch.
And that's your trigger finger right there. It gets stuck, and you have to, like, take your hand and straighten it out. And what you're doing is you're pulling it through, applying more pressure than your muscles can to pull it through. What your doctor's doing is injecting cortisone to reduce swelling. Now, if you pull the cord through with a bump on it, you can damage that soda straw, and then the soda straw swells, and now the thing really keeps sticking. So part of what the cortisone does is take the swelling down inside the soda straw, so now the cable can move more freely, and it can reduce the bumpiness of that spot, that scar tissue, because, again, that becomes inflamed, and then that swells, and the whole thing gets worse. So it works. Sometimes people never need to go to the next step, which is to go in surgically and either open up the soda straw or trim the tendon, depending upon what's...
That's the therapy that I've decided upon at this point.
Ultimately, people get sick of having to go in and have a painful procedure. Every 3 to 6 months. And, you know, sometimes you do one or two of these cortisone shots and the thing goes away and never comes back.
Yeah. I think this is my third, so I don't think I'm one of those people. And there isn't much room to put a needle in that area, you're right.
No, it hurts. It usually hurts. You're lucky that the first one didn't.
Yeah, my wife was amazed.
Yeah.
That's nothing to that, huh?
Well, she thought, wow, what a man.
Yeah. And then the last time she goes, oh, what a crybaby.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it was all you.
I'll grin and bear it.
Good luck with your surgery.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
For those of you who are concerned about that or have a family history, wearing padded gloves when you exercise, particularly weightlifting and biking or things that are palm intensive, is a good idea. And let's go to another email. This one from Kayla in Reading. Thimerosal allergy. My 77-year-old mother lives in Salinas, and she's been suffering from a whole body rash that travels for the past 6 weeks. It's extremely itchy and has caused pain in her joints, but responds to prednisone. She's being followed by an allergist. Skin testing, per the technician, showed thimerosal allergy. This is yet to be confirmed by the allergist at an appointment after the new year. Apparently, also, a culture grew out of fungal infection. My mother broke out in this rash 3 days after returning from New England via air, then one night in a hotel. Question, can thimerosal allergy cause all these problems, especially in a dermatitis type of reaction? She's really been very miserable and has lost a lot of sleep from this condition. Okay, interesting question. First of all, I think thimerosal allergy is present in your mother, but I think it's very unlikely that it has caused her rash. That's because I don't come up with a way that she could have been exposed to thimerosal topically. And you describe the rash as being on her whole body. And you also say it migrates and affects the joints. So yes, this is sounding like an allergic or an immune reaction. But I would want to point out that scabies would migrate and the inflammation, well, the loss of sleep all by itself can sometimes cause people to be pretty achy. So I'm just throwing out that could be a possibility. You said a fungal infection grew, and that surprises me because the only fungus that would grow out quickly would be candida. And generally, people only get a candida rash in their armpits, under their breasts, in their groin, areas that are warm and moist most of the time. So it'd be unlikely to be a total body rash or a rash that migrates to cooler, drier parts of the body if it were from candida. I did want to point out, you mentioned the hotel, and I wanted to throw out the idea of possibly bed bugs. Bed bugs have actually made a revival, and I've never seen bed bugs until this year, and I've seen several cases of people with obvious bed bug infestations or who had gotten rash from that. And the timing there is key. If you get bitten by bed bugs, the next morning you've got a scratchy, itchy little red dots all over the lower legs or whatever place on your body the bed bugs went to town on. I would be concerned if this is a systemic reaction, Kayla, that your mother may have a food or a drug allergy. And I would consider that much more likely if she started a new medication or a new herb sometime in the 2 weeks prior to the development of this rash. Sometimes these things can take a lot of investigation to figure out, so I want to wish you luck. The fact that it responds to prednisone, unfortunately, doesn't tell us much. That's a general immune suppressant, and it's like turning down the volume on the entire immune system. Yes, it will work, but it doesn't tell you why you need to turn the volume down. And we're going to Nick in Santa Cruz. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Fine, thank you. The reason I'm calling is because about two months ago, I blew out a disc and my back.
How old are you?
I don't know, 53, I guess.
53, okay.
And what I did was I wore ice packs for several, like about 30 days at least, 24 hours a day. And somehow the pain went away. But now I'm getting a little bit of tingling and numbness, which I understand can be similar to what I guess you were describing with the tendons. And I don't really want surgery or want to have cortisone shot in there, but I just would like a little more understanding of, you know, what risks are involved or, you know, what is actually going on. And when would I need to actually have some sort of invasive procedure? You know, because I understand that the numbness and stuff is because it might be some blood vessel or something that supplies it that's having some degradation.
No, not necessarily. Where is the numbness?
It's like down in the three center toes of my right foot.
Three center toes of your right foot. And does it involve the big toe at all?
No.
Okay.
No. Sometimes it seems like the big toe might be involved. Not very often.
Have you had any problems with weakness, any feeling like you don't have normal strength on that side?
No, not yet. Okay. I don't have anything.
And this is the left or the right leg?
It's on the right side.
Okay. Now, you no longer have any back pain, is that correct?
Very little. Sometimes I can feel. I don't have back pain, no.
Okay. No. And you can hold your body. You can be in any position. You can bend over. You can squat. You can stand up. You can twist. You can do normal movement without pain.
Yeah, pretty much. Right now, I'm just trying to build the strength back, doing sit-ups and, you know, some yoga, things like that.
So if the tingling is related to the back injury,
yes,
a good test for figuring that out would be to sit on the floor with your legs straight out, like you were going to stretch your hamstrings, you know, just sit on the floor, legs straight out in front of you, and kind of grab your ankles.
Mm-hmm.
And then while you're doing that, or however far down you can grab, I probably couldn't grab my ankles from that position. I tend to run to pretty tight. But you grab as far as you can, bend that back forward, and pay attention to whether the tingling increases.
Oh.
Because what we've just done by having you assume that position is we've put your sciatic nerve on stretch. And the sciatic nerve is the nerve that comes out from the lumbar vertebrae. It comes out from between L2 and L3, L4 and L5 and S1. Weaves together and goes down to your foot. And different parts of that nerve innervate different parts of the foot and leg. So by the location, it's going to be either L5 or S1 in most people. But if you put it on stretch and it doesn't change the tingling, then I wonder about it being some other cause.
Oh, really?
Yeah, exactly. Typically, a person would also have pain and tingling if it were due to a pinched nerve, but that isn't 100% true.
No, and I'm just trying this now, and I don't really get anything.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that probably you're a long way from needing surgery. I tend to advise people, you get operated on for uncontrollable pain or for loss of function. Mm-hmm. So if you can't control the pain, then you may need surgery if you go 2 or 3 months and it's not getting better. But when you operate for pain, there's at least a 30% chance that you won't fix the pain. And I just want people to know that going in. Now, if you're losing function, like your muscles are getting soft or you're weak, or somebody does testing on you and says this nerve is in danger of permanent damage, then your hand is forced. You have to operate, even though you know it may not fix the pain, because you don't want the person to end up crippled with long-term nerve damage because you waited too long.
When would I know that, or how would I know it? Would I have to have the testing, the electric testing?
Well, you know, it's really not likely, based on what you've told me, that you're even close to this situation. And I'm not going to be able to tell you a specific answer because it varies from individual to individual. But nothing you've said to me makes me worried that you need surgery. In fact, what you've said to me makes me worry that you'll go and get an MRI and someone will say, oh, see, this is terrible. You must have surgery.
No, I've had too many bad cases.
Yeah, in your situation, you had an injury of a disc, or at least it was diagnosed that way.
I've seen the MRIs, 90%
of these get better without surgery. The time frame for this is at the end of the first month, the person should have improved and no longer be in pain. That's typical. You're doing that. You're there. It's been a month. You're not in pain anymore. You're moving around. Your only residual finding is a little unusual tingling, which you can't make worse with position. So I'm not worried that there's that much pressure on the nerve. So,
what other things would cause the tingling? Could it be like low blood pressure or something like that?
Two things that top my list would be that there's compression on one of the superficial nerves that feeds that skin at the ankle. And so you're wearing a different pair of shoes, you laced your boots too tight, and you pinched the nerve, and your back was hurting too much for you to notice that you did that, but now you've got this residual tingling. So that would just be local nerve damage, local nerve pinch. Another possibility is vascular, but when you have a blood flow issue, it tends to affect the entire foot, not just a patch on the top of the foot. And I don't think it's nerve root pain because it doesn't go to your big toe and it doesn't go to your little toe. And the nerve roots divide the foot up in half. And so for it to just be the middle of the top of the foot has kind of a local wiring problem rather than a central wiring problem feel to me.
Oh.
Just based on the way the wires map, the nerves being the wires.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Essentially, somebody needs to do a careful examination. If I were going to send you to a specialist, I'd send you to a neurologist. I would go to the neurologist and I would say, the question is, what's this tingling on my foot and do I need to worry about it? Not, do I need back surgery? Because that's a different question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What's this tingling on my foot? Because the problem is, if you walk in there and you've got this in your head that, oh, it's the MRI and it's the disc, nobody has to think. Why are you paying the doctor if you're not paying them to think?
Well, I like to challenge them, because the first thing they wanted to do was give me cortisone.
Well, for what? You're not in pain. You don't need cortisone.
No, I mean then. Yeah. When it happened, I was in a lot of pain, severe pain, but I don't like, invasive surgery, so I told them no, and then it went away.
Well, and that's what it does do. But, the fact of the matter is, if you've got a tool and you can help somebody and they come in and could benefit, there's a tendency to push, get them to do it. So I understand your doctor's motivation to want to stick you, but I hope they respected your refusal.
Oh, they did. And helped you.
And you came out just the same as if you'd had the shot. 30 days later, you're fine. Except, it wasn't from the shot. It's just from your body's own ability to heal itself.
Okay. So the only thing was, I'm further concerned that there could be some further degradation.
Basically, for that to be in the cards, you would be in much worse shape. You'd be in constant pain. The pain comes first, okay? It's like this. It's pain, then tingling, then motor loss.
Oh.
So if you don't have the pain, I'm not so worried about the tingling.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because I'm not getting pain. That's it. I'm getting the tingling, but no pain.
Which is why you should sit tight.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you.
Bye-bye. So I wanted to take time to talk a little bit about a new medical device that the FDA just approved. This goes into the weird science category, for sure. The FDA recently cleared the NeuroStar TMS. This is the transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy system for the treatment of major depressive disorder in adults who have failed to achieve satisfactory improvement from one prior antidepressant medication, I'm quoting here, used at or above the minimum effective dose and duration for the current episode, which is a pretty small criteria. I mean, I wouldn't be cutting to the chase until I'd gone through several antidepressants. But this device, of course, is a machine, and therefore, because it's equipment, it's much easier to get approved than drugs. At the meeting back in January, when the Neurological Devices panel reviewed the device, the panel recommended against approval because they said that the data presented by the company had not shown the treatment to be effective for depression, and they recommended against approval. So the company went back and massaged their data, did some other different form of statistical analysis, and they found that, lo and behold, using different criteria for success, a large group of patients showed a positive response to treatment. And so it went through, and the fact that it's the tail end of the Bush administration and they're trying to do as much as possible for their friends probably has nothing to do with it. But anyway, this device does not meet the criteria for safety, in my view, and I'm really nervous about the idea. First of all, let me put it this way. If it actually works and it's not just a bell and whistle machine, I'm really worried about using this. It delivers an MRI strength magnetic pulse to the prefrontal cortex of the brain for 40 minutes every day for 4 to 6 weeks. That's a lot of magnetism to the brain. We know that if you put a strong enough magnetic dose into the brain, you can actually scramble and change thought waves. You can give people, in fact, a temporary expressive aphasia because the speech center is so close to the surface of the skull that you can get a really hefty magnetic dose in there. So we know we can scramble brainwaves. We've established that. This company has an approval and is out there trying to sell this chair to a friendly neighborhood psychiatrist near you. People who have refractory depression are going to be, well, shall we say, kind of desperate if they've gone through multiple drugs with no success. And essentially what they're trying to do is come up with a kinder, gentler form of electroshock therapy. But this isn't electroconvulsive therapy, and it doesn't even have data for success, which, brutal as it is, at least electroconvulsive shock therapy has decent data for success in the treatment of refractory depression. So all I can say is that the FDA considered this a low-risk device because there was no known mechanism for damage, which, if you ask me, is a pretty lousy criteria for clearing something that's literally designed to scramble people's brainwaves. Go figure. Let's talk to Will in Scotts Valley. Hello, Will. Welcome to the show.
I have another question about hair loss.
Okay.
I'm an 87-year-old man, and I've noticed this is nothing sudden. But I've had reduced hair on my arms, my legs, my chest, under my arms, and the pubic area. My beard, however, is full, both on the neck, mustache, sides, and the top of my head is thin. But I'm wondering, is this just old age, or is this a sign of some disease?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a sign of a disease, but it makes me want to check your testosterone level. And see if you have, well, andropause, as it's called, which is where the testosterone levels drop to quite low levels. Because body hair is more influenced by testosterone and DHEA, although you do say that you've got the beard still. I'd like to see your testosterone level, speaking as a clinician.
Mm-hmm. Actually, this came up. I was at the pool in the summer, and there was a younger guy there, about 50 years old. And he had that, and he had actually gone to a physician, and they were giving him some testosterone hormone.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Well, the only thing that happens when you get older is that you have a higher probability for the hormones to mess up, but the probability is low at, let's say, 30. It's a little higher at 50. It's a lot higher at 70. And we've been playing around now. We've had the ability to synthesize these hormones, and so you can go to a very expensive anti-aging clinic in this area and get injected with human growth hormone and all sorts of amazing things that supposedly bring you back to youth, you know, restore you to youthful hormone levels. I did research on this recently for a patient, and what I found was that the data on restoring testosterone is excellent, and that it actually, paradoxically, lowers cardiovascular risk in males to increase testosterone levels, which I would have thought the opposite, because I associate testosterone with earlier cardiac mortality, but it's not really that, it's that the estrogen's protective. Anyway, I'm digressing. The growth hormone data, on the other hand, was very shaky, and one of the things that came out from my doing this research was when you give people growth hormone, you're also giving them diabetes, and that's not a good way to do anti-aging. And some of these entities that do the growth hormone therapy actually, as part of their protocol, give Byetta, which is a drug to treat diabetes, and they give it proactively to people because it's cool and you can give it by injection, I think, is why they chose this drug, in order to keep people from developing diabetes from the growth hormone, which they're giving them to make them live longer. And it's just like twisted and scientifically illegitimate. In your case, however, we're talking testosterone. Replacement might be beneficial along a number of lines. It's probably worth looking into.
How is it administered, orally or?
There are creams, there are patches, and there are pills.
Oh.
So you can choose your dosing format. But I think getting a person's testosterone levels up to low normal, and that's always assuming that they do not have prostate cancer. We don't want to give growth hormone for the prostate, which is testosterone, to a cancer. But assuming that you test out negative, you're low risk for prostate cancer, testosterone supplementation is probably going to become the standard of care for individualized medicine.
Well, thank you very much.
Good luck to you.
I'll have that checked.
Good luck to you, and I'm sure you'll be waxing that chest hair in no time.
I also get very tired in the afternoon and evening, so maybe that's a factor also.
Could be, but yeah. I would also, if you're getting tired in the afternoon and evening, I'd be wondering about your sleep quality.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there are other things.
Multiple other things that could do that.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been a really interesting hour. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.